study and the fact that the Coast Guard could save considerable money by replacing the existing radar with this shipboard radar, a project was initiated to replace the radar at 3 VTSs.
Was the Raytheon system installed in San Francisco in 1981?
A shipboard version was installed in San Francisco at that time.
And were there any initial problems with the system, and were there any resulting modifications made?
I've only seen the documents, and the documents I've seen said that beyond the normal installation problems and getting it up and working, there were no further problems. It met all their needs. There were some suggestions made, and I believe Raytheon incorporated those suggestions into a production model of a shore-based VTS radar.
What was the rationale for the changeover? I understand the earlier radar was only 4 or 5 years old. What was the rationale for changing over to the new system?
Again, from the documents I've seen, the rationale was that the new radar saved a lot of money and met the needs of the VTS.
You've mentioned on two occasions already the needs of the VTS. Could you elaborate on that a little bit further, please? What those needs are?
Well, I can again go to the specific documents from the test that was done in VTS San Francisco. The CEO wrote a letter saying that this radar does meet our needs. He didn't specifically elaborate into types of ships, types of conditions, types of detection, ranges, any of that need. Basically, the VTS branch evaluated that installation and came to us as the engineering branch and said we would like this radar installed.
So it was the San Francisco VTS that initiated this change, not headquarters?
I don't know how it was initiated. I just know the test was done in San Francisco.
From your knowledge of the two systems, how does the Raytheon radar compare with the old AIL radar?
The old AIL radar had some different characteristics and it presented a clearer picture. However, the basic presentation was comparable, the basic performance is comparable. This was again reported by San Francisco in 81 that there was little difference between the performance of the two radars.
The Raytheon radar is a modified shipboard version, is that correct?
That's correct.
How is it modified for VTS service?
Now, the MTR, or the transceiver that we use at VTS, has greater power, about 2.5 times the power as does the shipboard version. The indicator is a sit-down console rather than a stand-up console, such as on the ship. The antenna that we use at the VTSs is an 18-foot antenna rather than a 6-foot antenna that's used on the ship.
You said the MTR or the magnetron was at greater power. How long did the MTRs designed to last on the old system? Do you recall?
I don't know.
If an MTR is over a period of time, will a degraded picture result as it wears out?
The MTR is the entire cabinet. The magnetron is a component within the MTR. But as time does go on, maintenance is required. Parts do wear out. That's why periodic maintenance is done.
How often are the MTRs replaced?
I don't know. The MTRs are replaced?
The magnetrons.
I don't know.
When the Raytheon system was initially installed, were there any problems that you observed?
We installed the systems in Valdez first, in Houston, Galveston second, and San Francisco third. Following the San Francisco installation, we received quite boisterous complaints from VTS San Francisco in that they were getting a lot of sea clutter, excessive sea clutter, and were losing targets in the sea clutter. We took a look at the situation and we realized that the system that we had purchased used a digitized method of remoting the information from the MTR back to the VTC, to the indicator. This digitized system was designed to reduce noise in the system for a long-range application. But we found that the digitization was actually creating the sea clutter, and that small information was small signal returns, such as sea clutter, was digitized to the same level as the small target. Therefore, the small targets and sea clutter came out to be the same level, and the targets were then lost in the sea clutter.
And what modifications did you make to the system?
We changed from a digitized system to an analog system, so this digitization was no longer done, and the sea clutter and the small targets can then seek their own level, so to speak.
Did this solve San Francisco's problem completely?
Solving their problem completely leads you to say, well, what was the complete problem?
Were there other factors involved?
You still have to specify some other factors.
Was there other reasons why you were experiencing sea clutter or interference? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, the reason we experienced sea clutter is because the antennas are mounted about 330 feet high at VTS San Francisco, looking down over the Pacific Ocean, pretty much broadside to the waves, and especially in the winter, in the afternoon when the winds would come up, you get considerable wave action, and since the antenna was at an angle down to the waves and broadside to the waves, they would get considerable reflection from the waves.
So are you saying because of the height of the antenna and plus the fact that the area experiences severe weather from time to time, that contributed to this problem?
It all contributed, right.
And what other steps did you take to solve this problem? Did you move the antenna, or what did you do?
Now, that system was left in place. One suggestion, we looked at various means of improving the situation, and one of the suggestions that was made was an installation of an S-band radar or a radar at a lower height. The solution that was chosen was a combination, installing an S-band radar at a lower height. We installed it about 200 feet lower than the X-band radar and at a lower height so that it gets less reflection from the waves. It grazes the waves more.
S-band radar is a 10-centimeter radar, for clarification. Did Valdez experience the same problems, and what was done to take care of them?
We didn't have the same severity of problems in Valdez. We did hear some complaints from Valdez that they were having trouble with sea return. At the time, we attributed it to the difference between the two radars, the AIL having different characteristics, produced less return, and we expected the operators to have to get used to the new radar. Once we realized what the problem was, we made the change throughout all the VTSs, all the installations, and we didn't hear any more complaints after that.
Now, when the Raytheon system was installed in Valdez, was the microwave towers replaced also?
No, they weren't.
And how old are those towers today?
I believe they've been in place since the VTS was established. Whenever that was, 76 or 77.
Are they due for replacement? Would they have any impact on the video presentation in the vessel traffic center?
Yes, they would.
And could you explain how the age of the microwave system might affect presentation?
Again, basically age wouldn't necessarily affect it per se. It depends on how they're maintained and quality of the transmission. If the microwave is introducing interference or introducing noise or not transmitting the signal at the levels it should, then the video levels presented to the indicator will be less than they should.
I'd like to call to your attention Exhibit 13B, Bravo, on page 2. Page 2, paragraph 5, this is a letter from the commanding officer, Marine Safety Office, Valdez, to the commandant via Commander 17th Coast Guard District. It appears that this letter is a six-month evaluation, the initial six-month evaluation of the Raytheon system. Paragraph 5 on page 2 discusses Commander Cavett's request that a 10-centimeter radar be installed. He stated that the system, if installed, could improve tracking ability in rain, wind, and snow. Was there a problem with rain, wind, and snow on the 3-centimeter radar that was installed?
Not that I was aware of at that time.
Why are you aware of why a 10-centimeter radar was not installed at his request?
No, I'm not.
On several occasions throughout the hearings, we've talked about how the use of the different range scales on the master and the slave radars could affect the sensitivity of the video presentation. Would you explain how the master-slave radar's relationship works prior to field change number 2, and explain field change number 2 and how that changed, please?
The basic radar transmits in three different groups. It's in the 3-mile scale and under, the 6 and 12-mile scale, and the 24-mile scale and over. In each of these three groups, the pulse repetition rate and the pulse width, essentially the pulse being transmitted by the radar, changes. Now, as long as the master and the slave are within the same grouping, that is either 3 miles and under, 6 or 12, or 24 and over, there's no problem in the relationship between the master and slave. I've been told and I've observed that if the slave is in a lesser range than the master, there wouldn't be a problem either, although you don't have an optimum condition. For example, if the master is in the 12-mile range and you put the slave on the 3-mile range, you will get a usable presentation, but you're not getting what the radar expects to be a 3-mile presentation. In the initial installation, with 2 identical transceivers installed at a remote site, you could use one or other of the transceivers as the master, and then the other indicator would be slave to that master. We realized in headquarters that this was a limitation. There may be a scenario where the operators would need to use both transceivers independently. So the engineering center in Wildwood, New Jersey, devised a field change, which came out to be field change number 2, that allowed both transceivers to be used independently. Therefore, 2 indicators could be master indicators, and the 2 transceivers operated entirely independently.
It's my understanding that on the night of the grounding of the Exxon Valdez that the vessel traffic control watchstander stated that the master was on the 6-mile scale and the slave was on the 12-mile scale. Is that correct?
I wouldn't know.
If that had been the situation, would that configuration based prior to the implementation of field change number 2, what would have been the approximate range capability of the slave radar?
Should still be 12 miles since it's still operating in the same region of 6 and 12 miles.
Now that field change number 2 has been implemented, do you see any potential advantages or disadvantages that come to mind?
As I stated, the potential advantage is you can have 2 transceivers operating entirely independently. A disadvantage is when you have them both operating, you're wearing out components twice as fast.
Do you anticipate that this will be a problem that you'll have trouble overcoming?
When you say you, who are
when
you?
When I say your branch is responsible for maintenance of these units, is that going to present a problem for your unit in Alameda?
Well, it wouldn't be a problem for us. The maintenance is actually done by the Marine Safety Office in Valdez. They have the technicians and they have the funding. If they choose to operate them independently, they're going to wear out components twice as fast and it'll require more funding.
Would that encourage a scenario where the capability to use both radars would be there, but only one would be operating at any time?
That'd be something that the commanding officer would have to answer.
Would you please describe how the overlays work and what is the capability of the overlays? How they can, if possible, can they be expanded to include more of Valdez Arm?
That the operators would know more about how the overlays actually work. I'm just have a general understanding. Essentially, they're a point-to-point line that is programmed to be displayed when the operator wants it to be displayed. And I believe there are 64 of these lines that can be programmed, and the operator can choose to have them displayed or not.
How accurate are these overlays?
As accurate as the operator programs them.
As accurate as plotting on a chart?
I couldn't answer that.
Are there any plans that you're aware of to install additional radars at Potato Point?
None that I'm aware of.
I'd like to take a few moments to talk about or ask you about the communication system in Prince William Sound. As I understand it, radar coverage extends from Alyeska Terminal through Entrance Island, through the Narrows, and basically out to, if optimistically, out to Bly Island. But what is the communication system used for as far as the monitoring of vessels in the remainder of Prince William Sound? Where are the sites located?
I couldn't answer how the system is used. That's an operational question, and I don't know exactly where the sites are located.
How are these sites maintained?
I believe they're maintained by a contractor.
And does the Coast Guard provide oversight over the contractors?
Obviously, yes.
I understand that on the night of the grounding, the Exxon Valdez, that the Naked Island site and the Hinchinbrook site, communication sites, were out. Could you give
us
a...
I'm not aware of the communications at all. A different branch is responsible for communications.
A couple weeks ago, your office offered to undergo a computer analysis of a comparison between the AIL radar that was in place before the Raytheon system and the Raytheon system. Would you describe the process involved in doing the study and your results?
As we obtained a computer program in about 1985. It resides at the Electronics Engineering Center in Wildwood, New Jersey. And this program uses various well-known published formulas to actually predict the performance of a radar under various conditions based on the characteristics of the radar itself. Since this came up, I realized this may be interesting information, so I had them actually plot the characteristics and the results, performance results of the AIL compared to the presently installed Raytheon radar. And the results are that both radars are essentially identical in their performance when using a vessel the size of the Exxon Valdez.
I have one other additional question regarding the tuning of the radars. Mr. Aldrich testified earlier that it would be the operator that would tune the radar. Isn't it a fact that whenever a component is replaced in a radar that the technician would also have to do additional tuning?
There is operator tuning that is done. I believe it matches the frequency of the receiver to the frequency of the magnetron. There is some drift in the magnetron frequency, so it optimizes the performance. But it is correct that when maintenance is done, some tuning is also required by the technician.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any other questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Dr. LaRush? Mr. Howitt?
No questions.
Captain?
No questions.
Thank you, Captain Deppe. Commander Waldron?
No questions.
Mr. Colucci.
In answer to one of the questions, you indicated that you knew of no plans to install an additional radar at Potato Point. Do you know if there are any plans to install any additional radar anywhere in the VTS system?
No, no plans to do an installation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Has the field change, I understand the field change too, was applicable to also the Houston installation and the San Francisco VTS. Was it installed at either of the other two?
I know it was installed in San Francisco. I don't know if it was installed in Houston.
Do you know of any adverse results of having installed it in San Francisco?
No, I don't.
Thank you. No more questions.
Mr. Armentrout.
Commander Opedal, you indicated that if, in order to save on equipment and wearing out components, you know, if it were used in a standby mode, it would save money. And if they chose to run both units full-time all the time, it would increase the cost. Can you give us some idea of how much maintenance costs per year you would expect it to increase?
That'd be a real hard.
Are we talking $50,000 or $20,000? I mean, some range.
I'd only be guessing, but I would say something. Then it's hard to say how quickly components will wear out. If we maybe focus on the magnetron itself, is what something that we know wears out regularly. I believe the cost of magnetrons is in the order of hundreds of dollars. So it would probably be somewhere from hundreds of dollars up to maybe somewhere in the thousands of dollars, but I'd just be guessing.
All right. And then one other final question. Would the use of radar reflectors, radar reflective devices aboard ship, enhance the primary returns that you get? Is it like air radar or aircraft radar?
Well, radar reflectors do produce a greater radar cross-section, greater return from the radar. I know they're usually used on small boats that don't offer a very big radar cross-section. A target the size of the Exxon Valdez produces its own massive radar cross-section. I don't believe that a radar reflector would enhance its return.
I'm only referring to the testimony we heard, sir, where, well, you certainly would see the Exxon Valdez if she was profiled to you with 1,000 foot of steel, and you would have less of a return if she was stern on or head on. Would the use of a reflector on the ship in that case make a difference, stern on, head on?
Now, I think it would depend on what radar cross section the reflector had to offer and if that was greater than the ship itself.
Do certain radar reflectors have a capability of enhancing the reflectability? That's what they're for,
yes.
Obviously.
Right.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Commander, just one other question on overlays. On these electronic overlays, we've heard earlier today that since the accident that the overlays are being used. Do these overlays have a dimmer switch, or is it just an on-off switch?
I'm not sure.
What I'm getting at is, if you're not sure, okay. Thank you, Commander. You're excused. I'd like to call our final witness for the Safety Board hearings today. It's Commander Paul J. Manette.
We heard from Lieutenant Commander Donald P. Opedal, who was in charge when they replaced the older radar with the newer Raytheon radar. He said a computer test that he just ran in New Jersey showed that they should pretty much behave the same when they get out to the further ranges. And now we have a man who neither of us know is what he's going to talk about, but he'll be the last witness. see who's going to be asking the questions here. Johnson has been the man who's been asking most of the questions when it comes to the technical things about the radar and its maintenance. We still really don't know how long that magnetron had been in there without being changed. We do know that they decrease in their performance with age, and that the operator on duty just before the grounding said that he thought his radar was a little bit out of tune.
Sorry, Commander. Mr. Colucciolo, will you swear in and qualify the witness, please?
Do you swear that the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Please be seated. Please state your full name.
Paul C. Monette. The J is incorrect, sir.
Thank you. Where are you stationed?
17th Coast Guard District Office in Juneau, Alaska.
And what are your duties?
I'm the Chief of the Command, Control, and Communications Division.
Mr. Johnson will ask you further questions.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Monette.
Good afternoon.
Is that Commander Monette? Is that the correct pronunciation, Monette?
Monette is correct.
Initial wrong.
Would you describe for us your duties and responsibilities in your current position?
Yes, sir. I'm in charge of two separate branches. One is the computer systems for throughout the state of Alaska within the Coast Guard, and the other is the telecommunications system throughout Alaska.
Could you give us a brief rundown of your electronic experience that you've obtained in the Coast Guard?
I joined the Coast Guard 26 years ago as a seaman recruit. I went to electronics technician school and have been involved in electronics, electronics engineering, electronics systems for the 26 years of my career.
I found out just a short while ago that you're also one of the last slick arm chiefs. Is that correct? What is that?
A slick arm chief is a petty officer who's risen through the ranks and made chief petty officer in less than 4 years.
Commander, what was your previous position in the Coast Guard, your previous assignment?
I was a chief of electronics engineering for the state of Alaska with the Coast Guard District 17.
Does that job entail overseeing the electronic maintenance of all electronic equipment in the state of Alaska for the Coast Guard?
It involves the electronic maintenance of all of the equipment, plus new installations, planning, and preparing proposals for replacements. Yes, sir.
Does it also involve overseeing contractors that are hired to maintain the equipment?
Yes, sir.
I'd like you to take a few moments to describe to us the components of the VTS in Prince William Sound, and I'd appreciate it if you include the location of some of the communication sites that are used, and also evaluation of the radar system there, please.
I look at VTS as a combination of two major systems, one system being the radar system, which has a couple of subsystems, and the second system would be the communications. The radar system doesn't do us very much good if we don't have a communications system, because that's the reporting method for the VTS to be able to talk to the ships and indeed be able to control them, if control is the right word, and I'm not sure that it is. It's to advise them, and they do that through the communications. The communication sites, we have one at Naked Island, which is a VHF FM. We have one at Hinchinbrook, which is a dual site. It's a VHF FM and a HF frequency site. We also have one at Cape Yakutaga, which is an HF site, and it is the system through which the initial reports of a tanker coming in would report to us. We also have a VHF FM site on at the VTS building itself. Reporting procedure through this communication system has a tremendous amount of redundancy built into it. For example, should any one of the VHF FM systems fail, there is a backup on the site, which is considered to be a hot standby. should one of the HF systems fail, it also has a backup, which is a hot standby. In addition, should we lose, say, the entire VHF-FM system, all of the sites go down, we still have the HF side of the house. And if we lose every bit of communications in Prince William Sound, we still have the Cape Yakutaga high-frequency site, which the ships can communicate with us throughout the transit of Prince William Sound.
So what role does the communication system play as a VTS? Is that a, can you break it down into percentages as far as the components of communication versus radar coverage?
Well, if we didn't have any radar coverage at all, I would imagine that tanker masters could report their position through the communications system, and the VTS would then at least have some idea of where they are. Without the communications, there is no system. But on the other hand, if you don't have a radar, there isn't very much of a system. The percentage is probably anybody's guess, but 60-40, 70-30, something like that.
I understand that the Naked Island communication site and the Hinchinbrook site was out of order. It was broken down on the evening of the 23rd of March. Do you know the circumstances surrounding those systems being down?
I don't know why they were down, but as far as the impact that they had on the situation that occurred with the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, probably very little, because we had the other backup systems in place and available for use.
And what backup systems were they?
That would be Cape Yakutaga and the VHF-FM at the VTC.
How are these communication sites maintained?
Maintained through a contract with a company called Electronic Engineering Systems, ESI, and I believe they're out of Omaha, Nebraska. They are responsible for the signal from microphone to antenna, if you will, so that if there's any problem whatsoever, they're required to respond within a certain time frame, normally 4 to 6 hours, and get it repaired.
Are you aware as how long the Naked Island and Hinchinbrook sites were out of order?
I understand that it was longer than the required repair time.
Do you have any idea why that is the case? Have there been problems with the contractor before?
I think the contractor was aware of it. He had been notified, and I can't speak for him. I don't understand why that wasn't repaired immediately.
Are you familiar with the Raytheon radar system that's installed at the VTS?
Somewhat familiar, yes, sir.
Have you sailed with this unit aboard Coast Guard cutters?
Yes, I have.
Are you familiar with the AIL system that was installed prior to the Raytheon system?
Only through reputation.
Do you have any idea why the Raytheon system was not capable of picking up targets on the 12-mile scale, why it could not pick up the Exxon Valdez on the night of the accident?
My sense of what may have happened, and the only thing that I can put together, is the normal problems that one has with any radar, being that it's influenced so drastically by weather. Now, if we had a weather front moving through any part of the system, not necessarily just surrounding the area of the Exxon Valdez, but if we had weather, a weather front passing even between the Exxon Valdez and the radar antenna itself, it could be blocked out. And interestingly enough, of course, is that that's a temporary condition as the storm front moves through. Radar is almost comparable to a television set, and a weather front may look like a small little piece of interference that starts up, say, in one corner of the screen. And as that weather front moves across, one would see that thing gradually moving and moving and obliterating everything in its path. If you shift to a smaller scale and look at it larger, then the amount of screen area that will be used and obliterated by that weather front is, of course, much larger. And if a weather front is indeed large enough, it could be 24 miles in diameter, then it would, in essence, make the entire radar useless.
By having a Raytheon radar installed in Valdez, how does that help the maintenance? Is maintenance more available for the Raytheon unit than for the other units?
Oh, absolutely. Considering that it's a Coast Guard standard, we have them installed in on most all of our ships, and we have certainly people who are more familiar with it because no matter where they go, they, and I'm speaking of our technician force, no matter where they go, they run into a Raytheon radar, and certainly the amount of training that we have to do is much less and certainly more successful because we're using a standardized system throughout the Coast Guard.
You said earlier that you have sailed with the Raytheon unit before. What are some of the advantages of the Raytheon system over the AIL system?
I'm not that familiar with the AIL, but from what I've heard, that the biggest advantage is that we're able to maintain it far more easily. Our people are more familiar with its operation and its characteristics. They know what to expect, so they're not caught by surprise.
Has the movement of the Electronics Maintenance Division to Alameda had an effect on the maintenance of the communication system in Prince William Sound?
We have a three-tier maintenance system throughout the Coast Guard. We have what we call the individual units who have electronic technicians assigned. It would be Tier 1. Tier 2 would be a support system such as what we have in Kodiak, which is the Electronic Maintenance Detachment. So that in the event that a lad runs into a problem with a particular piece of equipment, he refers that problem, in this case, to Kodiak, where they have a collection of more experienced people. In the event that even the second level fails, then we bring into account the third tier, which are the people stationed in Alameda, where they have the design engineers and the field tech reps. They would then go out and assist with the problem if they weren't able to solve it over the telephone.
What impact does the weather patterns in Prince William Sound have upon the maintenance of these communication units?
Rather severe. One of the interesting reasons for having a totally redundant radar system is that in the event that one fails, we still have another one because people simply can't get out there at any given time because of the weather. When you have 30-foot seas, we're not going to launch somebody and take a chance on creating a safety hazard.
When you were chief of the electronics engineering branch in the state of Alaska for the Coast Guard, did you experience any problems getting technicians to the sites in Prince William Sound on account of weather?
Well, there were days when we simply wouldn't launch anybody because it wasn't practical.
How long of a weather window would you have?
3 or 4 days sometimes.
Does the addition of the Raytheon system help you take advantage of that weather window? I guess the question should have been, has a three-tier system, as far as the maintenance, expedited the maintenance process as far as the communication sites?
We had the three-tier system in place before. I think you're referring to Coast Guard realignment 2 years ago and the shift of the electronic maintenance responsibility from the Juneau office to Alameda. The third tier in the old system was in Juneau. The third tier is now in Alameda. We haven't really seen a degradation in the response time other than to those things that are administered by the contractor.
What kind of problems have you had with the contractor?
Sites didn't work, sir. He didn't repair them.
He didn't fulfill the end of the contract, is that what you're saying? Does this happen on a regular basis?
No, it hasn't happened that often from my understanding, but a better person, the folks in Alameda would have a better feel for that. But this site was down. They were responsible to repair it.
Are there any penalties imposed when they don't respond within a certain period of time?
There are. There's a penalty clause in the contract which has been used several times. When I was administering the contract, I have penalized the contractor. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Commander. I don't have any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Dr. LaRoche? Mr. Hallett?
No questions.
Captain Deppe?
No questions.
Mr. Colucciello?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No questions.
See?
What about him?
Mr. Colucciello?
Commander, are there any Raycons installed in the 17th District?
We have Raycons that were installed on a seasonal basis up on the North Slope, particularly when polar ice breakers were transiting the area.
But other...
I'm not aware that there are any others.
I see. Do you see the installation of Raycon as being a very difficult or expensive thing to do?
No, sir.
And do you... Well, I don't know if you're a navigator, but do you see any advantage in installing some of these in Prince William Sound?
Usually we install Raycons when there are no navigational aids, and particularly on the North Slope when there are no distinguishable characteristics of the surrounding terrain. As you know, the North Slope is quite flat. Prince William Sound has some very distinctive and definitive geography, and I think that people can readily determine where they are.
I see. You don't normally then install a Raycon to highlight the presence of a particular danger of some sort, such as a reef?
No, sir.
Okay. No more questions.
Mr. Armentrout?
Commander Monette, just one quick one. The state pilot Murphy was giving his testimony. He said that when he went to his quarters, the pilot's quarters, he heard about the ice that the previous vessel, Arco Juno, had encountered. Is that, and maybe you can answer this, but would the state pilot, what did he mean by that? Do they monitor the frequencies at state pilots? Location?
They talk among themselves, absolutely, the state pilots. It's somewhat similar, I would imagine, to a pilot report in the aircraft industry. Pilot flies along, finds some clear air turbulence. He files a report back with the nearest tower so that the next fellow to come along the same route would have that information and not be caught by surprise.
And then one other thing on... just a quick follow-up on Hinchinbrook and Naked Island radio difficulties. I would assume probably those two sites were repaired subsequent to the accident quite quickly for ease in communication within the first 24 hours, or do you really know?
Naked Island was within 24 hours.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Danaher?
Commander, I had just one question. As you undoubtedly know, in aviation, radar transponders are widely used as a means of enhancing the reception of radar, of airborne targets. In your opinion, would the use of such a transponder on vessels using the VTS significantly enhance the reliability of being able to receive signals more independently of the weather conditions prevailing?
It would be an interesting test to try that out, particularly with some of the weather systems that exist in Valdez.
Do Coast Guard vessels normally have a transponder on them?
No, sir, but we do put the transponders on the helicopters when they're deployed on polar icebreakers so that we can find them in the ice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Let me just follow on to Mr. Danaher's. Are you aware of any Coast Guard program that is considering putting transponders on vessels?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Thank you, Commander, for your time and testimony. Your excuse.
One more.
Sorry? Oh. Sure, Mr. Johnson.
May I ask the Commander just one more question? Commander, would you care to comment on the ability of a 3-centimeter radar and a 10-centimeter radar to detect ice in Valdez Arm from Potato Point site?
Let me just use the basis of my experience using the two different radars on a on an icebreaker in ice. We didn't really detect a measurable difference between the 3 and 10 centimeter radar. Ice is a very interesting phenomenon. As testimony has been brought out here before, the cross-sectional area of an object doesn't necessarily determine its radar reflectability. As an example of that, many people are familiar, I think, with the radar reflectors that are sold to enhance the visibility of a sailboat. And these reflectors are about the size of a basketball, but because of their inherent design, they offer a radar, a target that looks like it's about a 35-foot steel-hulled ship. Ice does just the opposite, not only because of the kind of contours that are present so often in ice, but also ice tends to, if you will, take energy out of the wave that's available to be reflected electronically so that it absorbs the radar signal. Ice is very difficult to predict how it will perform, and I haven't seen a measurable difference between the two different radars.
Commander, where did you receive your experience with radar and ice?
On the Coast Guard cutter Northwind, polar icebreaker, and that was between 6 and 4 years ago.
Thank you, Commander.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Since we had a follow-up, Captain Deppe, Mr. Howitt, Dr. LaRush, Commander Waldron. Thank you. You're excused. With the last witness having been heard, this concludes this phase of the Safety Board's investigation. In closing, I want to emphasize that this investigation will remain open to receive at any time new and pertinent information concerning this accident. The Board may, at its discretion, reopen the hearing in order to obtain such information, and this new information would be made a part of the public record. The Board welcomes any information or recommendations which may assist it in its efforts to ensure maritime safety. Any such recommendation should be sent to the National Transportation Safety Board in Washington, D.C., 20594, within 30 days after the receipt of the transcript of this hearing. Now, I would caution the party coordinators, Captain Deppe, Mr. Howitt, Commander Waldron, and Dr. LaRush, to keep in touch with the hearing officer, Mr. Colucciello, in case there's any change in that. But we welcome your recommendations, we welcome your suggestions, we welcome your identification of probable cause. It will be, all the information you present to us will be considered in our analysis in the development of the report and further work. On behalf of the Safety Board, I want to thank the parties for their assistance during this proceeding. I also want to express appreciation to all those groups, parties, persons, corporations, and agencies who have provided their talents throughout this long week. The record of the investigation, including the transcript of the hearing and all exhibits entered into the record, will become part of the Safety Board's public docket and will be available for inspection at the Board's Washington, D.C. office. Anyone wanting to purchase this transcript should contact the court reporter. Let me say that again. We will not be providing transcripts to anybody. We have one. It will remain in the public docket. I urge you to get in touch with the court reporter and make arrangements to get your own transcript. I now declare this hearing to be in recess indefinitely. Thank you.
Well, it's certainly been a long one. We have just seen the conclusion of the National Transportation Safety Board public hearing inquiry into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. That doesn't mean it's over. As Lee Dickinson, the chairman of the Board of Inquiry, just said, we'll keep this open for another 30 days for people to tell us what they think about what might have caused this. And I don't think we really know at the conclusion of this, do we?
Steve, we've sat here for 5 days now. Do you have a sense of what happened? I sure don't. I think there's more unanswered questions. I think there are as many unanswered questions at the end of this hearing as there are when we walked into it. We know a whole lot more details. We know some things that happened, but I don't know that we've got any answers.
Well, I was making a list of the things that we learned. And I think we did solve some puzzles, and I think we just put other puzzles in their place. But maybe the puzzles we now have in place are a little bit more manageable. We did learn that there was an eyewitness who says that the captain was drinking before the wreck. And what this, if you extrapolate back from when we learned why it took so long to take the blood alcohol test, and we learned if you extrapolate back, he would have been quite drunk at the time he was making these critical decisions. There was also the question, if the captain is drunk, was he impaired? People repeatedly said, many people said they didn't smell alcohol in his breath. There was contradictory testimony on that. Some said that they did smell alcohol in his breath, but those who worked with him did not. And there was a question, did you notice any sign of impairment over and over again? And almost unanimously, they said no. But then you take Commander Waldron's point when he went through a whole long list of things that the captain had done, gross misjudgments, you know, turning the ship over to somebody that wasn't qualified.
Standing on a bridge and smoking a cigarette in
right,
the middle of,
right.
With fumes in the background.
Putting the autopilot on in waters where you're supposed to have a pilot. And he said, isn't this impairment? And, you know, then you have to turn to the whole question of the psychological climate aboard tankers and if there's something wrong with that. We heard from a lookout who didn't realize that there was a problem with having a red, when you're leaving a port, there's a problem when you have a red light on the starboard side. Now, that is the most fundamental thing that a lookout should know, and somehow this lookout didn't know, didn't realize there was a problem. We learned an awful lot about radars. We learned a whole lot about, we learned that the radar operator at the time couldn't see the Exxon Valdez, and earlier we had heard that he wasn't looking for the Exxon Valdez. We heard conjecture just a moment ago that possibly it was the weather that had influenced the radar. We learned that the radar, there had been a, this was a relatively new radar, and the previous radar might have been superior, but there's contradictory testimony on that. We learned in any event that this radar had not been optimized, that there had been on the books for a couple of years, more than 2 years, I guess, in order to...
August of 1987 was when the field order number 2 was put in, and that was, in many respects, the most interesting and significant piece of testimony today, that there was a change order that would have given the radar better vision in Bligh Reef and the whole area far beyond the Valdez Narrows, would have allowed them to see the Valdez Narrows and Prince William Sound all at the same time. And that change order was not made. We learned that.
We learned a lot about kind of, I guess you'd have to say, the deregulation story. The way that down through the years, the things that are required of tankers and their captains and their pilots and so forth have been kind of eroded, and how Frank Iorossi has really, you know, in many ways made his reputation on cutting costs as the president of Exxon Shipping Corporation, cutting down on how many people they had to pay and how many duties they had and when they had to have how many officers on board. And that there's been a pattern of cost cutting that has sort of gone on without anybody really realizing it. We heard much the same sort of thing when we talked about the contingency plans. What do you do if oil spills? If you really look at the contingency plan, as we learned in this federal report yesterday, it doesn't make a lick of sense when it comes to the... it's just not realistic when it comes to enormous amounts of oil such as was spilled into Prince William Sound. We had Denny Kelso testifying here that they thought the plan was okay, and they approved it. And Exxon and Alyeska are asking him questions as if he should have never approved it because he should have known that they could never do what they said they could do in the plan. But when you read the plan, it's clear. It's off in Disneyland someplace. It's not really a realistic plan of what could actually be done about an enormous oil spill. There again, a case of erosion a case of erosion of regulatory responsibility, increasingly like it turns into a world of paperwork, and it's not really a world of reality. And I think that's the bottom line that we've seen here. We also had the navigational question answered to some degree. When did the ship start to turn? When did the captain tell the third mate to start turning the ship? How shallow was the water underneath? I've learned that you can have 20 feet of freeboard underneath your vessel, an enormous tanker like this, and still experience a vast increase in your turning radius. As the bottom creeps up on it, you cannot turn as hard. Maybe that entered into it. People are poring over those charts. And the chart was the spot that we learned at this hearing is different from the spot that we that the third mate said he had been told by the captain to make his turn. At any rate, the vessel didn't make the turn, and it went right into the reef. And then there's this, finally, I guess the last thing that we really didn't learn about, we heard a lot about, was the whole question of ice and how much ice there might have been there to avoid in the first place. Was there ice? Wasn't there ice? There had been some ice. Some people saw ice. Some people didn't see ice. And the testimony there is wildly contradictory. And I would predict it would take some kind of satellite imagery, something objective, to really straighten that one out.
In fact, today it had appeared for a while that there might have been some question as to whether Greg Cousins was using the right radar to try and find the ice. They have the ice. There are 3-centimeter radar, 10-centimeter radar, and the pilot, Ed Murphy, was saying he gets better returns on ice and better returns and better vision using that 10. Today we just had a radar expert, a man who served on an icebreaker, who ought to know from ice, and a man who said, doesn't matter, you get the same results either way.
It sucks the stuff up. You can't get much of an image out of it.
So we've unanswered questions. We certainly have the ice as a big one. It seems to me that the autopilot still remains an unanswered question.
It really does,
They know that it was shut off, but the big question is, when was it shut off, and was it shut off too late? Was the autopilot shut off when Greg Cousins says it was at about 12:53, or did he and helmsman Kagan make a panic dive for the button when they realized that the ship wasn't responding the way it was supposed to?
And so that those are some of the unanswered questions, and they will remain unanswered as far as this body is concerned for about a year. You know, they deliberate for quite a while before they ever come up with, they pore over this record and any new evidence that's brought to them, and it'll be about a year, maybe even more, before we get a final report on this.
The other big unanswered question remains Joseph Hazelwood, the man who was not here, the man who we've heard a lot about, but we get some interesting pictures of him. He's a very quiet person, kind of almost a dark, brooding person, someone who was definitely acting the way masters don't usually act on this particular night, going below when he should normally have been on the bridge, being out of contact with his crew at times that a master is normally in contact with his crew and in command.
And
someone who clearly has,
by
all accounts, a technical, highly competent tanker captain, someone who obviously has a tremendous amount of loyalty from his crew.
Yeah, that comes across, and from those who knew him, like Pilot Murphy, for instance, you know, who couldn't say enough to defend Joe Hazelwood, regardless of the fact that he's one of the people that had lunch with him at the pizza place.
So we get different stories, and we still have a lot of contradictory evidence, and the board certainly has its work cut out for us. It's not our job to draw conclusions, and I think these folks are going to have an interesting time drawing some out of all of these. Is this kind of the way you expected it to be, Steve?
Yeah, it is, actually. I know how they work because I watched them with the Ryan hearings, and it's a noble effort to try and put something like this on the air because it is so exhaustively thorough that it's bound to also get very, very draggy at points, and we've seen that.
We also saw some sort of bureaucratic side trips. We saw this strange little excursion into a turf battle between the Department of Transportation and the National Transportation Safety Board over post-accident testing.
That's right.
Drug testing, and we saw the safety board drag in an official of Department of Transportation from Washington and ask her some very tough questions about their drug policy, a policy which says that they only test for drugs, they don't test for alcohol. They use urine tests, which moments before a toxicologist had testified is basically worthless when you get far away from the accident, within hours after the accident. And basically the NTSB was saying that we don't get the kind of information we need, and you've got this policy, and we had people taking drug tests, but your guidelines don't help us get the kind of results that we want.
Yeah, it's been an adventure, I'd say. I feel like I'm in a very different position than I was when this started last Tuesday.
Well, I guess on that note, we'll end up with wrapping up here. This concludes our coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board Anchorage hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. I'm Bruce Melzer. With me has been Steve Heimel. We've also had help from Corey Flintoff. Our setup engineer was Bill Glynn. Coverage of this NTSB hearing is brought to you by KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Good afternoon. It's 2:15. You're listening to KSKA FM 91.1. Coming up next, a Prairie Home Companion. Dan Aykroyd said he loved...